Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. This month, we're revisiting some of our favorite episodes of Modern Love, the podcast, that have been adapted for television. This week, we'll go back to a story by Terry Chaney. It's about dating while living with bipolar disorder. It's episode 3 of The Amazon Show. Actor Rebecca Hall read Terry's essay for the podcast back in 2016. You may know Rebecca as Vicky in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. She also stars in the upcoming thriller, The Night House.
As a bipolar woman, I've lived much of my life in a constant state of becoming someone else. The precise term for my disorder is ultra-radian rapid cycler, which means that without medication, I am at the mercy of my own spectacular mood swings. Up for days, charming, talkative, effusive, funny, and productive, but never sleeping and ultimately hard to be around. Then down, and essentially immobile, for weeks at a time. This darkness started for me in high school, when I simply couldn't get out of bed one morning. No problem, except I stayed there for 21 days. As this pattern continued, my parents, friends, and teachers grew concerned. But they just thought that I was... eccentric. After all, I remained a stellar student, never misbehaved, and graduated as class valedictorian. Vassar was the same, where I thrived academically despite my mental illness. I then sailed through law school and quickly found career success as an entertainment lawyer in Los Angeles, where I represented celebrities and major motion picture studios. All the while I searched for help through an endless parade of doctors, therapists, drugs, and harrowing treatments like electroshock, to no avail. Other than doctors, nobody knew. At work, where my skills and productivity were all that mattered, I could hide my secret with relative ease. I kept friends and family unaware with elaborate excuses, only showing up when I was sure to impress. But my personal life was another story. In love, there's no hiding. You have to let someone know who you are. But I didn't have a clue who I was from one moment to the next. When dating me, you might go to bed with Madame Bovary and wake up with Hester Prynne. Worst of all, my manic, charming self was constantly putting me into situations that my down self couldn't handle. For example, one morning I met a man in the supermarket produce aisle. I hadn't slept for 3 days, but you wouldn't have known it to look at me. My eyes glowed green, my strawberry blonde hair put the strawberries to shame, and I literally sparkled. I'd worn a gold sequined shirt to the supermarket. Manic taste is always bad. I was hungry, but not for produce. I was hungry for him. In his well-worn jeans, Yankees cap slightly askew. I pulled my cart alongside his and started lasciviously squeezing a peach. I like them nice and firm. Don't you? He nodded. And no bruises. That's all I needed. An opening and I was off. I told him my name, asked him his likes and dislikes in fruit, sports, presidential candidates, and women. I talked so quickly I barely had time to hear his answers. I didn't buy any peaches, but I left with a dinner date on Saturday, 2 nights away, leaving plenty of time to rest, shave my legs, and pick out the perfect outfit. But by the time I got home, the darkness had already descended. I didn't feel like ploughing through my closet or unpacking the groceries. I just left them on the counter to rot or not rot. What did it matter? I didn't even change my sequined shirt. I tumbled into bed as I was and stayed there. My body felt as if I'd been dipped in slow-drying concrete. It was all I could do to draw a breath in and push it back out, over and over. I would have cried from the sheer monotony of it, but tears were too much effort. On Saturday afternoon, the phone rang. I was still in bed and had to force myself to roll over, pick it up and mutter, "Hello?" "It's Jeff. From the Peaches. Just calling to confirm your address." Jeff? Peaches? I vaguely remember talking to someone who fit that description, but it seemed a lifetime ago. And that wasn't me doing the talking then, or at least not this me. I'd never wear sequins in the morning. But my conscience knew better. "Get up, get dressed," it hissed in my ear. "It doesn't matter if she made the date. You've got to see it through." When Jeff showed up at 7, I was dressed and ready, but more for a funeral than a date. I was swathed in black and hadn't put on any makeup, so my naturally fair skin looked ghostly and wan. But I opened the door and even held up my cheek to be kissed. I took no pleasure in the feel of his lips on my skin. Pleasure was for the living. I had nothing to say, not then or at dinner. So Jeff talked, a lot at first, then less and less, until finally, during dessert, he asked, "You don't by any chance have a twin, do you?" And yet I was crushed when he didn't call. A couple of weeks later, I awoke to a world gone Disney. Daffodil sunshine, robin's egg sky. Birds were trilling outside my window, a song no doubt created especially for me. I couldn't stand it a minute longer. I flung back the covers and danced in my nightie. My grey flannel prison issue nightie. I caught one glimpse of it in the mirror, shuddered and flung it off too. I rifled through my closet for something decent to wear. But everything I put my hands on was wrong. For starters, it was all black. I hated black, even more than I hated grey. Redheads should be true to their colours, whatever the cost. I dug deeper, and there, shoved way in the back, was a pair of skin-tight jeans and something silky and sparkly and just what I needed. An exquisite gold sequined shirt. Damn, I looked good. Then I tugged on the jeans. I'd gained a few pounds during the last couple of weeks of sloth-like existence, but once I yanked really hard, they zipped up fine. Although something was sticking out of the pocket. A business card with a few words scribbled across the back. "Call me Jeff. Jeff. Jeff." I kicked the nightie out of my way and grabbed the bedside phone. Was 6:30 a.m. too early to call? No, not for good old Jeff. It rang and rang. I was about to give up when a thick, sleepy voice said, "Hello? It's me. Why haven't you called?" It took a while to establish who me was, but eventually he remembered. "You sound different," he said. "Or no, maybe you sound more like yourself. I'm not sure. It's so early." Soon I had him laughing so hard he got the hiccups and had to get off the phone. But before he did, he asked me out for Friday, 3 nights away. "No," I insisted, "it had to be tonight. Or even this afternoon." I didn't want to lose another chance to get to know him. I knew that Cinderella had only so much time left at the ball. We compromised on dinner that evening at 8. I spent the afternoon ridding my house of all evidence of depression. I soaped and scoured and dusted and vacuumed, using every attachment, even the ones that frightened me. Then I ran out and bought a dozen Casablanca lilies to hide the smell of ammonia and bleach. When the house looked perfect, I turned on myself with the same fury. I buffed and polished and creamed and plucked and did everything in my power to recreate Rita Hayworth's smoky allure in Gilda. As I was shadowing my eyes, I remembered her poignant line about the movie. Every man I've known has fallen in love with Gilda and wakened with me. It gnawed at me, to the point that my hand started trembling and I couldn't finish applying my mascara. Suddenly I didn't look radiant. There were lines around my mouth and a hollowness to my eyes that aged me 10 years. My skin, despite the carefully applied foundation and blush, was so deathly pale I recoiled from my reflection. I sat on the toilet and started to cry. I had met the enemy enough times to know it by sight. "Not now," I prayed. "Please, not now." Globs of mascara ran down my cheeks, and I wiped them away, heedless of the streaks they left. It was 7:57. I had 3 minutes to wrestle my brain chemistry into submission. Oh, sure, I knew there was another option. I could tell Jeff what was going on. But this was a man who didn't even like his peaches bruised. What would he think of a damaged psyche? Maybe he would understand. Maybe I would find the courage. Maybe they would invent a cure. Maybe, but not tonight. As the doorbell rang and rang, I huddled in the bathroom, shivering. I was terrified, not just of Jeff finding me there, but of me never once finding love. When it was finally quiet, I rinsed off the rest of my mascara and tossed my cocktail dress into the hamper. Then I buttoned up my grey flannel nightie and settled in for the long night to come. I never heard from Jeff again. That was 5 years ago. 5 long years of ups and downs, of searching for just the right doctor and just the right dose. I've finally accepted that there is no cure for the chemical imbalance in my brain, any more than there is a cure for love. But there's a little yellow pill I'm very fond of, and a pale blue one, and some pretty pink capsules, and a handful of other colours that have turned my life around. Under their influence, I'm a different person yet again. Neither Madame Bovary nor Hester Prynne, but someone in between. I have moods, but they don't send me spinning into an alternate persona. Stability, ironically, is so exciting, I have decided to venture into dating again. I have succumbed to pressure from friends and signed up for 3 months of a computer dating service. "Who are you?" the questionnaire asks at the start. I want to be honest, but I don't know how to answer. Who am I now, or who was I then? Life seems so much tamer these days, deceptively quiet, like a tiger with velveted paws. Every so often the sun shines too bright, and I think, for a moment, that I own the sky. I think how wonderful it was to be Gilda, if only in my own mind. But then I remember the price of the sky. So I take off my makeup, rumple my hair, and go to the supermarket in sweats. The gold sequined shirt languishes in my closet. I'm thinking of giving it away. Not just yet.
Rebecca Hall, reading Terry Chaney's essay, "Take Me As I Am, Whoever I Am." More from Terry after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When Terry Chaney's Modern Love essay was published, she unexpectedly became a poster girl for bipolar disorder.
I was inundated by emails, I'd say maybe thousands of them, telling me their stories with bipolar disorder and thanking me for telling mine. And while there were many sad stories, there was also a lot of courage and resilience and just empathy for the condition.
When her book Manic, a Memoir, was published 2 weeks later, it shot to the top of the bestseller lists. Then requests for speaking engagements came pouring in from across the globe. All welcome, of course, but Terry's struggle with bipolar disorder made it more difficult to take full advantage of these new opportunities.
Well, it's a day-by-day situation. Actually, for the past several years, I've been pretty stable on medications. Thank God we have the right cocktail at the moment, because I've seen what I'm like without it, and it isn't pretty. But there are definitely times when I just wish I could be highly manic again and have that exhilaration. But I know the consequences by now, and it just isn't worth it.
So what was it like to reveal this very personal story in such a public way?
Before Manic came out, I didn't disclose to anyone about my illness, not my lovers, my friends, my coworkers, nobody except my doctors. And then after Manic was published, I suddenly got all these emails from ex-lovers, ex-boyfriends saying, I always knew there was something wrong with you. I just couldn't put my finger on it. Now it completely makes sense. So I was able to repair a lot of those broken relationships, which was certainly a benefit I didn't expect from disclosure. I was so terrified to tell anyone.
And did she ever hear from the guy, Jeff?
I never heard from Jeff again. It was funny. I expected to when the essay came out, because I heard from, it seemed, every other person in my past crawled out of the woodwork, but I did not hear from him.
Terry is in a great relationship now. Her partner has taken the time to understand what it means to be bipolar and what it means to date someone with bipolar disorder. He's so familiar with Terry's ups and downs that he can even see when trouble might be coming.
The Santa Ana winds were predicted to blow in Southern California, and he warned me ahead of time that, okay, you're going to get manic, because I always get manic during Santa Ana's. And he told me to, you know, batten down the hatches, call my therapist, take my medication. I mean, he knew before I did what was going to happen.
Terry will be bipolar for the rest of her life. But does she ever wish it all away?
My answer to that is no. I get so many strange benefits from it, my creativity being probably the most salient, but also just a sense of being empathetic and more attuned to the world, I think, than many other people.
Terry Chaney, author of this week's essay, Take Me As I Am, Whoever I Am. Terry lives in Los Angeles and continues to write full time. Her third book will be out this fall. So why do people like Terry decide to reveal so much of their lives in this particular column? Modern Love editor Dan Jones has a theory. We'll talk with him after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
If you've listened to past Modern Love episodes or read the column in the Sunday New York Times, you know the stories can be intense. From open adoption to suicide, war, death, disease. So why do people share their deepest secrets through this column? That's what we asked Dan Jones, Modern Love editor for the New York Times.
I don't know why Modern Love has become, in a way, such a platform for people to admit to and describe in detail really sensitive, vulnerable things about themselves that then can be read about by hundreds of thousands of people or more. There's a little bit of an important sort of self-delusion that comes with personal essay writing, where when you're in the process of doing it, you aren't really imagining an audience, or at least a lot of people who submit to Modern Love aren't, because the odds of getting published are really slim. And there's something that is very both sort of cathartic, liberating, intense, and brave in a personal way about doing that. You know, they can control the message. It's in their words. And once they have that control and feel like they have that control, they can really just sort of open the floodgates and say, okay, this is who I am.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. This week's essay was read by Rebecca Hall. So what drew her to this particular story?
I found it a very moving portrayal of something that I have some understanding of, I suppose. I know people that deal with this. Also, in the movie Christine, I play someone who is, you know, struggling with profound mental health issues, although they're not named. We don't know if we can put a name to it, like bipolar, like we could now. In 1974, there wasn't quite that language. But I felt that I had some understanding and some access to this.
Christine tells the true story of Christine Chubbuck, a frustrated newscaster in Sarasota, Florida. In 1974, she committed suicide on live television.
There's something about Christine that parallels this story, because Christine is definitely a character who I thought a lot about, being someone who is performing what she thinks to be normal when she's having a sort of off day. And she's always trying to moderate her performance of how to be her from one day to the next. And sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's terrible. And how people around her see that and deal with it, and how much they do accept her, even if she doesn't think they do. And this essay talks about performance in that way, or the personas, or the different versions of one person.
Thanks again to Rebecca Hall. Christine opens in select theaters this week. We'll link to the trailer on our website, wbur.org/modernlove. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. This episode was produced by Jessica Alpert and John Parati. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. Additional music, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and my other job is hosting an NPR show called On Point. Check it out in your podcast feed. We'll see you next week.